Hello, this is episode 43 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, March 5th, 2009. I'm your host, Baron Soka of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. There's been a lot of talk lately about how the Internet can be used to increase the openness and accountability of government. While that conversation usually focuses on the executive and legislative branches of the federal government, on this week's show, we'll be discussing the equally vital issue of public access to court records. Joining me for today's discussion about these issues are some e-government experts who closely monitor developments in this field. First, TLF contributor Tim Lee, adjunct fellow at the Cato Institute and member of the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton University. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Baron.
Steve Schultz, fellow of the Berkman Center at Harvard University. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Baron. Glad to be here.
And James Grimmelman, associate professor, New York Law School. Hi, James.
Hi, Baron.
So, Steve, can you get us started? What's happening to make this issue fresh?
Sure. So this past Friday, we had a fairly interesting development. Senator Lieberman wrote a letter to the courts, essentially to the head of the federal court system, asking a few very pointed questions about their policy on giving public access to court records. And he wrote this in the context of a bill called the E-Government Act of 2002, which he was a primary sponsor of. And he was asking some questions about how the federal courts had implemented the requirements of that act. Specifically, that act had made some important statutory changes, saying the terms under which the judiciary could provide access to court records. It said that rather than being required to charge for them, as it had said in the past, that they may only charge to the extent necessary. And it also stated in the committee report that came along with it, which is where they sort of discuss what their intent was with passing the act, it said that their ultimate goal was for the courts to move towards a free system. So from a fee-based system where they charge a fee for access to a free system. And Lieberman observed that the courts had not moved at all in that direction. In fact, they were charging more than they had been charging at the time. And he asked how they were complying with the act, whether or not they were really charging only to the extent necessary, only their costs in doing so.
Well, Steve, it sounds like that provides a pretty good outline for our conversation. But before we start unpacking some of those issues, James, could you get us started on the history of public access to the courts, why it's important, and how it's been done in the past?
Sure. Public access to information about what courts have been doing goes right along with public access to being able to use the courts at all. That is, if you think about the court system as something that provides justice, that justice is really deficient unless the courts are doing so openly. You know, if the courts are making their decisions in secret, no one can ever find out what their rulings are. We have very few checks on them. I mean, they have very little way of knowing if they're actually following the law or doing justice in particular cases. And to the extent that court records are hidden away and kept from people, it becomes much harder to find out what your duties under the law is. You can't look up past court interpretations to find out how courts have interpreted the law and what you're supposed to do. You have no guarantee that judges in different parts of the country or even in the same courtroom from day to day will apply the law consistently. And the people who have a lot of money and resources can spend more time figuring out what ought to be easily findoutable by anyone. That creates inequality in the legal system. So for centuries, the courts in the U.S. and in other countries have operated on the principle that basic records of what they do need to be publicly available. At the very least, the written opinions that judges give whenever they issue a decision have to be published and made known to the world. And at least if you go down to the courthouse, you can actually look in the files and see all of the other documents. You can see what the parties' arguments were. You can see what issues the judges considered. You can see, in essence, what happened and really be assured that the courts were following proper procedures.
So, James, if you were to draw broad philosophical issues at stake here, what would you say they are?
I would say that paying attention to court records is important for democracy and the rule of law. It's important to fairness so that people know what the law is. It's important for consistency so that the law really is one thing in one place and not changing all the time. And it's important for ensuring equality in society.
Great introduction. Well, Steve, you started telling us about what Senator Lieberman has been doing lately, but can you give us a little more historical background on how the courts have used electronic delivery systems to make court records available?
Sure. Well, as James described, historically, your means of accessing information about judgments and about what happened in the course of a case has been to go to the paper record. And traditionally, that paper record is maintained by the courts themselves, or in some cases, after a certain amount of time, at least in the United States, these things are aggregated and put into the National Archives, and you have to go look them up. Starting in the 80s, there was a substantial shift which came about largely because it became so much easier to digitize and remotely access information. And the courts began putting certain amounts of case information available through electronic means. This started out as a dial-up service, which would provide you with certain basic case information and would charge you by the minute for every minute that you accessed it. So if you recall what it was like to use AOL or CompuServe back in the day, it was a similar sort of system. And they called the system PACER, which stands for Public Access to Court Electronic Records. And near the in the late 90s, they saw the internet starting to grow and the web becoming quite popular and usable. And they said, hey, maybe we should make this available over the web instead or in addition. And the courts began to transition their system to be available over the web. And as they did so, they switched from a model of charging by the minute to charging by the document. And they've now been through a couple of iterations of this web-based system. And over the course of doing so, they've also improved their technologies for doing electronic filing to the point that nearly every document that's filed in federal cases is filed electronically and then immediately available through this public access system. So there is a vast infrastructure constructed by the judiciary to support this electronic filing. And it is a tremendous improvement over the days in which everything was done on paper, both for those who are practicing law and are involved in the cases themselves, because it lowers costs and makes it easier to file, and for people who want to observe what's going on in the courtroom.
Well, Steve, for those of our listeners who are not legal practitioners and who haven't used PACER, what kind of documents are we talking about here?
So jurisdictionally, we're talking about everything that is happening in federal district court, which is essentially the first court you would go to if you were trying a federal case. And federal circuit court, or at least most federal circuit court, the circuit or appeals courts, I think about half or two-thirds of the appeals courts are now using a version of PACER. And the Supreme Court currently doesn't use it, but because it's such lower volume and so gets so much attention, those opinions are in general published fairly quickly. And the specific documents in question are, as James hinted to, there are opinions or specific orders of the court, and then there are all of the other supporting documentation. So that might include lawyers, legal briefs, or pieces of evidence, or other motions by other parties in the case.
Well, Tim, let me bring you in here. What's wrong with how PACER works today?
Well, what's wrong with how PACER works today is that it's, you know, stuck in the 1990s, if not the 1980s. The moving from a paper system to an electronic system was a great advance, but the the economics of providing this information has changed over the last decade. A decade ago, the courts had to run all these modems and have all this very expensive infrastructure in order to provide this service. Nowadays, as we all know, there are all sorts of very small companies that provide free access to information over the web, and so this model where you have to pay, it's 8 cents a page, where page is a physical page if it's a PDF document, and they have a sort of quasi-page for HTML documents, that model is no longer anywhere close to the best that the courts could be doing in terms of making the information broadly available. There's also some other technological problems with the way PACER works. For example, if I want to get information about, say, in all the cases that deal with some aspect of copyright law, there's no one search engine where I can go and search all the district courts at once. I have to go to each of the several dozen district court, because each court runs its own PACER system, so I have to go to each court's website and do a separate search, which, as a practical matter, means that many of the sorts of searches that we're used to being able to run on the web, it's not possible to run with this system, even though the courts do, in fact, have electronic documents and could build a unified search engine. And there's lots of other problems that I think James could probably say more about than me with just the way it's implemented. It feels like a very primitive, mid-1990s kind of website, which is just not, just doesn't compare to the modern search and organizational tools that we take for granted everywhere else.
I would just add to Tim's note about the searchability. You have to go to the different court sites to search on most of the criteria, and in addition to that, there is no search engine available even on an individual court level to search within those documents.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Right, or even in the case of something like copyright, there are a very few number of terms which you can search on. You can search for all patent-related cases, I believe. But I'm not sure if there's a copyright-specific categorization. And, in fact, if you're interested in a topic which isn't one of the few nature of suit codes, there's no way of finding that within the system.
Thanks, Steve. So, James, how does this situation compare to accessibility of other federal records?
So I won't say that the federal government is perfect in all of its other legal material accessibility, but compared with the judiciary, it's far superior. The government printing office and the Library of Congress together make most of the executive and legislative materials that we care about accessible in quite reasonable ways. You can go to government websites and search within the United States Code, or which is the statutes passed by Congress, or within the Code of Federal Regulations, which are the regulations promulgated by the executive branch, and you can get those for free on the web using much more modern interfaces than PACER offers in a way that lets you actually browse through things and look across them and do comparisons reasonably readily. And the Thomas system, which tracks legislation, the bills currently in Congress, is actually up to date within 24 hours and provides pretty good access as you can track the classic process of a bill becoming a law. So it's not as though the federal government doesn't have the resources or the intelligence or the capacity to do this right.
Okay, James, but so what? I mean, why should the average person care? Why isn't this just a problem for the legal profession?
In part because it's the inaccessibility of these records that makes it just for the legal system. If only lawyers know about this and can get at it and have the account to sign up for it, they keep legal knowledge in their hands and they keep their monopoly on access to the legal system.
And what impact does this have on policymaking more generally?
It makes the public less aware of what the law actually says. It disengages them from being engaged in the political process. It makes it more expensive to hire a lawyer. It really shuts people out from their own government.
Baron, one example I have sort of a non-lawyer's perspective, and for a couple of years I've been writing about legal decisions from a non-lawyer but hopefully at least somewhat knowledgeable perspective on the legal system. Until I started really looking into PACER as a policy issue, I didn't really understand how the PACER system worked. I didn't really even realize that that court records were available online. Sometimes somebody else would post, like a public interest group would post a decision on the web, and then I could download it and I could read it and I could write a story about it. But I think that the difficulty of finding court decisions, among other things, makes it very difficult for journalists who are not experts on navigating PACER to get information about court decisions, to understand how the legal system works, and to write stories that would allow ordinary citizens to better understand the laws and the precedents that affected their lives.
And to be clear here, Tim, we're not just talking about court decisions. We're talking about all filings, whether they're arguments or briefs and things that could be relevant for any kind of journalism.
I mean, exactly. So even if I'm able to get, let's say that EFF puts up a brief from or a copy of a decision, if I want to get the supporting information, the arguments that were made on both sides and so forth, I might still have to wrestle with PACER in order to get access to those documents and pay not a huge amount of money, but there's a significant barrier to entry where if you have some sort of citizen blogger who's interested in a subject but not interested in enough to do a ton of work, this is a real barrier. And I think in the big picture, it limits people's access to information about how the judicial process works.
Well, guys, this sounds like a no-brainer. So what's the problem? Why can't we get this fixed?
Well, I think that part of it is momentum and the way that the PACER system started. There was an interesting article written by the judiciary itself in its own sort of internal newsletter discussing the history of PACER. It's 20 years old at this point. And they noted that they didn't think that the system could ever have been developed without being self-supporting, because they had to sort of prove that it was worthwhile. The specific economics of this come down to appropriations from Congress. Essentially, there are two ways they could support the cost of the system: appropriations from Congress, or having some sort of a self-supporting system. And they did not think early on that Congress was likely to give them appropriations for this untested system, which they would have to build from the ground up. And so there's a certain amount of momentum there, because that's how the system has worked. There is genuine concern around whether or not they could get appropriations from Congress to pay for it going forward. Now, in their own reports, they discuss the cost of the system, and for example, in 2006, they said that it cost about $11 million or so to run the system, plus about $20 million to run the electronic filing system for attorneys, sort of on the input side. We might estimate that the total cost is $30 million or so, and it might be going up year to year, or it might vary depending on how much they need to invest in it. Now, that wouldn't be a tremendous congressional outlay, but they would have to ask for it. And in an era when there's a lot of back and forth between the courts and Congress about how much they'll pay for judges' salaries, building new courthouses, that sort of thing, it's a difficult conversation to have in some sense. And because they have the momentum of it being self-supporting in this way, see it as a perfectly working system that they don't want to necessarily touch. Now, the other component of it is that it appears that in recent years, at least in the last 10 years or so, the PACER system has begun to generate profits above and beyond the cost of the system. There was a report from 2006 which quotes the total profits at over $60 million, whereas the total costs, as I just described those two areas, if we included those two areas as a generous estimate, it would be about $20 to $30 million. And so, in fact, the courts have found a way to start supporting other activities that does not require congressional outlays. And they're limited in that they can only spend it on information technology-related items because the fund that they're paying this into and paying it out of is related to the information technology, but they have a lot of those costs. So they are disincentivized, at least from an economic perspective, to go to Congress and say, well, why don't you just provide us with the funds to run the system and we'll provide it for free, because they're in fact making money off of it.
So, Steve, you're tying these two problems together, of the fact that PACER is on the one hand expensive and on the other hand it's not very functional, because it sounds like the judiciary just doesn't have any incentive to innovate and upgrade the system.
Well, they have incentive to innovate and upgrade for the class of users that is paying for the system. There is a great quote by a guy named Peter Martin where he talks about this. I'm just going to give you the quote. So Peter Martin wrote a paper. He says, PACER's financial dependence on the market value of court records has had an effect on system design. Features with reasonable prospect of furthering the foundational goals of transparency, judicial accountability, public education, and informed debate on informed matters of policy have been ignored or rejected. Otherwise beneficial arrangements that might have threatened the willingness of the commercial sector to pay PACER fees have not been treated as realistic options. And I think he's got it dead on there.
I think it's important to distinguish two costs. So there's, on the one hand, there's the like internal infrastructure of the courts. I mean, it makes sense in these, in the 21st century to have the parties to cases submit their documents electronically. And even if PACER didn't exist, presumably the courts would be doing that kind of work. On the other side, you have the sort of public-facing part where they're providing the documents to the world. And one of the things that some of my colleagues here at Princeton have pointed out is that, the private sector is often much better at providing indexing and searching and for these kinds of documents, and that if the courts were to simply make them available in some sort of raw bulk form, I'm sure, for example, that Google would be happy to send a courier over, once a week or something to get a disk containing that week's court decisions and, cover all of the costs of sticking them on the web and building a search engine around it and so forth. So the costs, this $30 million is largely costs that are either internal costs that the courts really, that should be part of the court's basic appropriations, or are costs of building this website that probably isn't as good as the websites that the private sector would build for free if they had the opportunity.
I think that's very true, that in some ways the judiciary sees an exaggerated cost to maintain the PACER system, precisely because they have made it so hard to use and so hard to build easily accessible free alternatives to it.
James, what other obstacles do you see here to upgrading PACER?
One of the biggest obstacles to genuine open access is the privacy concern. And this is something that is traditionally how legal scholars have thought about access to court records, because all sorts of sensitive information goes into documents produced in litigation. You're going to have potentially trade secrets discussed in them. You're going to have social security numbers and other sensitive information like that, particularly in immigration cases often. And you have, in criminal cases, very sensitive information about investigative techniques and informers. And a lot of this information really, for proper substantive reasons, shouldn't really be public. And there's a very large redaction problem that the courts in some ways have dealt with primarily through assuming what's called practical obscurity. It's sitting in a document somewhere that is in theory publicly accessible. But since we know that most people won't actually go to the courthouse to look at it, we can treat it as not being public. Suddenly, if everything is available on a website, searchable, potentially being republished broadly, then you have a lot more privacy concerns. And I think there's no way around that issue. It's that you have to address both these concerns at once. and do good redaction and privacy maintenance precisely at the same time as you open it up broadly to the public.
James, that sounds like it would take a lot of work for each court to do that. How much of a problem is that, really?
In some ways, it's work that the courts ought to be doing already. So this ought to be built into our estimates of how expensive it is to run a court system. If you need more people in the clerk's office to properly redact documents, that seems like part of the cost of trying cases that include sensitive information.
And this is something the courts do, right? I mean, there's some question about whether they do it adequately, but at least in theory, they're already supposed to be doing this, right?
Well, yes. That's right. It's somewhat divided responsibility for things that the court is publishing, absolutely. For documents that are filed by parties to a case, they have responsibilities, and there are very clear rules, and there are punishments and sanctions for breaking rules about publishing personal information. But in reality, the social expectations and the enforcement is relatively weak, and it is relatively weak in part because of this exactly what James was discussing, this historical notion of practical obscurity, and because of the historical idea of practical obscurity and this notion that the PACER system is in some sense preserving it by putting everything between a paywall. There haven't been changes in expectations at the courts and by practitioners around what they should actually redact. The reality is that it's a false sense of security because there are some parties or some entities out there which are pulling down PACER data in bulk and making it available and using it to do things like credit checks or that sort of thing. So the information is getting pulled down, but the result is right now, because it's behind a paywall and because the courts have chosen not to pay much attention to it, it's something which is happening in the background without our awareness. You could imagine that if this were all available publicly and out there in the sunlight, that there would be more attention paid and, in fact, a more aggressive policy of redaction and proper privacy management.
Thanks, Steve. Before we finish, I want to ask James about one major issue that remains to be discussed, which is the copyrightability of government records. James, how does that apply here?
You sometimes see government agencies trying to argue that there is some kind of a copyright in their work, and the private republishers, the Lexis and Westlaws of the world, who go and they get all this data in bulk by sending, going into PACER and downloading all of it, and then they put it in their services and they sell it at a steep markup. They try to argue that they can get a copyright in their database organization or their paginated version of the court opinions. And there's a very old principle that the works produced by the government aren't really the kind of thing that ought to be used for copyright. Because copyright's about giving people incentives to be creative and to make new things. But it's the government's job already to run the legal system and to produce laws. It's not as though we're going to get more laws or better laws if we give a copyright over it. So sort of for historical reasons and reasons that are often recognized in copyright doctrine, the government doesn't take copyright in things that it produces itself.
Well, I'm sure the last thing any of us wants is more laws, although perhaps in this case it does sound like Congress really ought to do something. So to close, could each of you share your thoughts on what Congress ought to do here? Tim, let me start with you.
Well, I think Congress should appropriate the amount of money that's required for certainly the internal operations of the court's IT systems, and then instruct the courts to make the raw information available in the cheapest way that they can, and allow private sector entities like Google or various nonprofit organizations like the Sunlight Foundation to make that information available to the public in a variety of different formats. And hopefully we'll see a bunch of different approaches and sort of market competition to decide what the best way to search and organize these records is.
Steve, what do you think?
I would agree with Tim, and I would add that Congress should pay close attention to the laws that it has already passed. I think Lieberman's highlighting of the E-Government Act of 2002 is absolutely appropriate. And looking at both the text of that act and the intent of the committee as expressed in that act, that the judiciary move towards this no-fee system, I think would be a good approach. And I think that the motivation and justification is spot on. Encouraging public access rather than simply practitioner access is a laudable, important, and historically consistent goal.
James, you get the last word.
And I agree completely with Steve and Tim. The Congress should give the courts the funding they need to do redaction and privacy concerns properly and to put data online at a baseline of easily accessible formats, both in bulk and simple, no-frills browsable, and then invite private parties in to provide better indexing and search and better republication and combinations in ways that we can't even imagine yet.
Well, thanks, guys. That's going to do it for Technology Policy Weekly this week. I want to thank Tim, Steve, and James for joining me. To read more commentary from the entire Technology Liberation Front gang, visit us at techliberation.com. If you'd like to comment on something we said here today, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can comment on this page for the show. If you liked what you heard, please tell a friend, write a review of our show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next time, I'm Baron Soka of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. See you then.